The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jen Rogers from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from Smithsonian Magazine. Today's programming is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat DeKeppen. We wish to thank them for their support. On today's program, we'll continue reading from the March 2021 issue of Smithsonian Magazine, and we'll finish up an article that we started last week titled Pi is a Constant, in Naples, the Formula Calls for Pizza. In this article, we learned about the history of pizza, and we had just finished learning about Enzo Coccia, who runs a pie-making academy in Naples. And the author asked Coccia to name a Neapolitan pizzaiolo, which is a pizza maker, at the pinnacle of his profession. Attilio Bacchetti, he says without hesitation. He makes the lightest, most digestible pizza there is. Bacchetti, who shapes the pies at Pizzeria da Attilio, is smiling but ascetic, a lovable obsessive whose devotion to pizza is complete. The son of a pizzaiolo who himself was the son of a pizzaiolo, began his apprenticeship at age 6. He's now 56. Da Attilio is an unpretentious gastronomic shrine smack in the middle of the lively Pignasecca market. You are greeted at the door by Maria Francesca Marinello, daughter-in-law of the Attilio Bacchetti, who opened the joint in 1938, and mother of the Attilio Bacchetti, who presides over it now. The walls are blanketed in press clippings, celebrity photos, and framed napkin doodles, many of which picture the chef molding his precise and studied creations. Bacchetti says the secret to Da Attilio's airy crusts is little yeast, lots of thyme. His signature dish is the Carnevale, a Baroque fantasy of tomato, sausage, and fior di latte, flour of milk, mozzarella that sports an eight-pointed crust folded around sweet ricotta. His other showstoppers, Pizza Giandera, also 8 points packed with grilled mushrooms and sautéed vegetables. Pizza Cosacca, a marinara margarita hybrid, mozzarella out, grated cheese in, and bacchetti, little kisses, spiral rolls of dough bursting with ricotta and provola and perfumed with nutmeg and black pepper. The precision of Bacchetti's hand movements is something to behold. He'll grab a ball of dough, bloated from a two-day prove, and slap it onto a lightly floured marble countertop, pressing his fingertips gently from the center of the bloat towards the edges. He gingerly massages, punches, stretches, and turns it back on itself. He spreads a few tablespoons of tomato sauce over the dough, crowns it with cheese and herbs, drizzles on olive oil, and pulls the edges of the crust taut over the small round palate of a pollino, a long-handled stainless steel turning peel. Then he slides the impasto into the glowing mouth of the oven and gently rotates the pizza while it cooks. After a minute, he centers the pollino under the crust and lifts it slightly to give the underside a final char, a technique known as doming. On the journey between plate and mouth, the bouncing strings of molten cheese seem to be alive. They're not, of course, though technically the crust was before it was browned. Before I arrived in Naples, Katie Parla, author of Food of the Italian South, warned me. Once you've been to Pepe and Grani, you'll never be able to eat pizza anywhere else ever again. For 3 years running, Pepe and Grani, the showplace of Pizzaiolo Franco Pepe, has been voted Italy's finest pizzeria in the Top 50 Pizza Guide, a prestigious list judged by Italian culinary heavyweights. Los Angeles chef Nancy Silverton, whose Pizzeria Mozza is North America's preeminent sourdough establishment, likens Pepe's pies to perfectly roasted marshmallows. The perfect marshmallow is not one that goes right into the flame and charred, she says. It takes patience to be near a flame and get that beautiful caramelization. Franco has achieved perfection through his mastery of pizza making. It feels almost like he invented pizzas and the rest of us are just copying him. Deliberately working outside Naples and the reach of Associazione Verace Pizza Napoletana, Pepe excels by breaking all the laws governing Neapolitan pizza. He fashions outlaw pies that triumph despite everyone's worst wishes for them. On this mild Mediterranean evening, Pepe lopes through his restaurant looking happy, proud, at peace. Pepe Grani is housed in a restored 18th century palazzo in the old Roman hill town of Caiazzo, located about an hour or so northeast of Naples. It's a block away from his grandfather's bakery, where there were no recipes, scales, clocks, or machinery. Pepe's family cooked a occhio, guessing at a glance. Year after year, I watched my father construct dough from scratch, he says. He never wrote anything down for me. He didn't have to. I knew instinctively how dough should feel. Day by day, to suit the weather and humidity, I changed the mix, 11 times the quantity of yeast. I never refrigerate the dough. Tactile experience teaches you it is wet and asking for flour, when it's stiff and needs to be bathed, when it's ready to be stretched and no longer wants to be touched. Mechanical technique will not help. Dough is like a baby. You must listen closely to grasp what it desires. Evidently, what the dough desires is to stay home. Pepe is the most noteworthy holdout against takeout and delivery. Since nearly all his diners are out-of-towners, he decided to cease operations until the restaurant could reopen. The distance that delivery would have to cover is way too long for enjoying the product. It would be ruined, he says. I don't believe that pizza would hold. My pizzas can only be eaten on the spot. Pepe credits much of his success to his flour, some of which is milled from an indigenous grain last grown in the region in the 1950s. He rejects the commercial flour decreed by the AVPM. To help preserve customs and established practices, I source ingredients almost exclusively from local suppliers, he recounts with terse modesty. The cheese is made and the onions grown for him alone. He collaborates with small farms to revive disappearing heirloom species, such as the Pomodoro Ricchio. Vernio Genuine, the extra virgin olive oil, is produced from age-old groves a couple of miles away. The oregano comes from a nearby town of Matisse. The sausage from a breed of black swine that some 20 years ago, pig farmers in the Caiazzo area brought back from the brink of extinction. I changed the future of pizza by looking backward, says Pepe. A Neapolitan pizza olio is only as good as his margarita, and Pepe's are otherworldly. His margarita sabliata, roughly margarita gone wrong, is a playful deconstruction of Raffaele's Esposito's 19th century pie. Rather than spoon tomato sauce on a cheesy crust and bake it together, he bakes just the cheese in the crust. When the white base emerges from the oven, he embellishes it with a basil reduction and a few graphic lines of tomato puree. A marriage of hot and cold, cooked and raw. You get the classic margarita flavors turned upside down. Pepe treats many of his specialties the same way, placing individual toppings, fig jam, mortadella with creme fraiche upon the heated pies. Parla observes, every pizza is the fruit of thoughtful planning, planting, producing, and harvesting, which respects the rhythms of nature and transmits flavor, which will simply change the way you think about food. If there's a millennial chef capable of taking Neapolitan pizza to the next level, it may be Ciro Oliva, the 28-year-old behind Pizzeria Don Concettina at Tre Santi has a boyish, uninhibited manner and a spontaneous, beaming smile. His great-grandmother, Concettina, began selling fried pizza in the same building in the Earthy Sanita section of the city. The entire shop consisted of an oven and a window to hand out food to customers on the street, he says. Order Oliva's decadent 12-course tasting menu, and he'll serve you himself with elaborate explanations of each experimental dish. The novelties run the gamut from pizza bagels to butter, salmon and caviar-studded pies, to the memory of a sundae, a hodgepodge of tomato, parsley, and creamy clam sauce. No forks or knives required, Oliva counsels. Eat with hands, always. His response to the lockdown restrictions was to devise four different boxed kits, the standard margarita, salami, deep-fried, and anchovies and black olives. The do-it-yourself instructions come with a caveat. The pre-made dough should rise for no more than 48 hours. Let the dough prove too long, Oliva warns, and the yeast expends its gas-producing energy, leaving you with a dense, deflated pie. He's a generous soul who genuinely cares about the fellow Neapolitans in need. He pays the cost of English lessons for neighborhood kids so they won't be tempted to join the Camorra. That's the local mafia. For about $3, Oliva will provide a pie to anyone who can't afford to buy his or her own. If a customer is broke, he'll defer payment for 8 days, a long-standing Neapolitan practice called pizza a otto, or eight-day pizza. The citizenry of Naples lives close by a volcano that's both a memento mori and an index of the human condition. In a city with a predilection for light and shade, optimism coexists with the sober reality of death. During this era of COVID, when time can seem suspended, perhaps no Neapolitan custom is as poignant as the pizza suspensa, the suspended pizza, a form of generosity that involves eating one pie and paying for two, leaving the other for a less fortunate stranger. No one should be denied a pizza, Oliva says. It's the food of solidarity. Next, we'll move on to an article titled The Ice is Calling by Neil Ever Osborne and Mark Jacquemain. A climate change dispatch from the polar bear capital of the world. On the bay this fall morning, there's a wind-carved rim of ice and a gathering of floes. One male polar bear, Bony, after a season without seal blubber, struggles along the slushy edge, haunches soaked, nearly slipping into the sea. We are on Gordon Point in northern Manitoba, where Hudson Bay widens into its northwest crescent. Polar winds make it colder than at comparable latitudes, and the shallow waters of the bay freeze early. Having passed the summer months in the subarctic wild of Wapusk National Park to the south, polar bears now congregate here, waiting for the ice to come in. The air is harsh, dry, frigid. We huddle on the deck of Tundra Buggy 1, a big-wheeled bus retrofitted for traveling over frozen ground and viewing polar bears. Jeff York, Senior Director of Conservation for Polar Bears International, PBI, uses Buggy 1 as a roving research station. It's equipped with GPS, Wi-Fi, and polar bear cams that beam live footage to classrooms around the world. PBI monitors polar bears across the Arctic partly to determine the impacts of climate change on the behavior and physical condition of the animals, as well as population trends. One program has tracked polar bears outfitted with GPS ear tags or collars that transmit locations to researchers to gain insight into the animal's movements. York says, "Our understanding of polar bear biology, ecology, and behavior is critical for long-term conservation and can inform on-the-ground efforts like human-bear conflict management." From the deck of Buggy 1, there are several bears in sight, mostly large males. Invisible in the Arctic blizzard, their double-layer coats, not stark white but golden like sheep's wool, stand out faintly in the distance on a clear day such as this. They tussle playfully or sleep among the twiggy willow stands on shore. One immense bear sits human-like on its haunches, blades of grass in its teeth. Others wander the ice rim with a lazy gait that belies their lethal quickness. York has warned us of the threat the bears pose. The big bears have likely scared off the family groups, York says, explaining that at this desperate time of year, when adults are near starving before the sealing season, males are more likely to cannibalize cubs and attack humans. Despite the dangers, York has focused his 22-year career on stewardship of the polar bear. He and his wife, Rachel, are planning to move from Montana to Manitoba so he can be close to them. The polar bear has become perhaps the preeminent symbol of the consequences of climate change because it needs sea ice to survive. From November, when the ice fastens to shore, to May, when it breaks up, the ice is polar bear territory across the Arctic. The bears sleep on the ice at night, and pregnant females can even hibernate there during the winter. Males and non-pregnant females stay active through the winter days, and the ice is their hunting ground. Laying ambush behind a pressure ridge of ice fragments, the bears stalk seals. On the ice, they're slow, York says of the seals. The bears are explosive as they run them down. There are between 16,000 and 31,000 polar bears in the world today, congregating in 19 populations across the Arctic. In some areas where the bears were heavily impacted by hunting, bans helped their numbers resurge. But the shrinking of their Arctic habitat is making the species more and more fragile worldwide. In Greenland and Norway, the World Wildlife Foundation listed polar bears as vulnerable. In Russia, they're rare or recovering, depending on the location. And in Alaska, the only place in the United States where they're found, polar bears are threatened. In Canada, where 60 to 80% of the polar bears live, there are species of special concern, a click of the dial below threatened or endangered. The population in the Western Hudson is particularly at risk, having fallen from 1,200 polar bears in the 1990s to about 800 today. Climate change has shrunk the expanse of sea ice that once spread from the North Pole to southern Hudson Bay. In 2020, the ice area was the second smallest since measuring began in the 1970s, and it is thinner than ever. During our visit in early November, the bay's newly formed ice, having warmed, began to shatter like a teacup. Days later, a south wind pushed it all ashore. We need north winds bringing cool air and a few days at minus 20 Celsius, York said, a note of concern in his voice. Polar bears are hardy creatures. They can fast for upward of 180 days and swim hundreds of miles without a break. But consensus among scientists is the animals won't be able to find new food sources once they can no longer hunt seals. If a warming climate shrinks sea ice at projected rates, most polar bear populations will be too nutrient-starved to reproduce by the end of the 21st century. Meanwhile, shrinking sea ice seems to be leading bears to wander into human settlements from Russia to Norway, Greenland to Alaska. Problems ensue. In Alaska, an offshoot of a Russian polar bear patrol program trains communities to use tools like bear spray, flashlights, air horns, and rubber bullets to deter bears and protect themselves, while Canada's Nunavut territory administers similar efforts through a polar bear conflict manager based in Iqaluit. Here in northern Manitoba, a comparable program operates in Churchill, the polar bear capital of the world. Churchill is a town utterly of the north. Its gridded blocks of aluminum-sided houses sit between miles of cratered tundra and the icy mouth of the Churchill River. This cold flank of Hudson Bay was once a meeting place for Inuit hunters and the Cree and Dene First Nations. Today, almost three-quarters of Churchill's almost 900 residents identify as Indigenous. The town boasts one of the only movie theaters within 1,000 miles, as well as access to Canada's only deep-water port in the Arctic. As the climate warms, more bears wander into Churchill to scavenge, or moon around in backyards, or chew the seat off a snowmobile. Mayor Michael Spence, a member of the Cree First Nation, says bear sightings were a novelty when he was a boy in the early 1960s. He remembers playing in a game of road hockey that was interrupted by a mother and two cubs. But today, they are more common. On Halloween 2013, a 30-year-old woman named Erin Green, who had moved to Churchill from Montreal the previous year, was leaving a party with friends when she looked over her shoulder. "There's this bear that's already full speed running at us," Green says. While her friends ran for help, the bear began carrying her off. I realized that this was a fight I couldn't win on my own and just accepted that this was the way I was going to die, she says. Just in time, a neighbor appeared, striking the bear's head with a shovel. The bear dropped her, and she was airlifted to the hospital to treat her life-threatening injuries. Despite the terrifying ordeal Green suffered, the scars and occasional pain she still bears, she returned to Churchill. The reason, she says, is a quality particular to the North. The cold burns your face, the sky is beautiful, the animals could be around every corner. It's so real, it's so raw, she says. She feels a different connection to polar bears now, a different understanding. Her medical bills added up to thousands of dollars, but the local community paid them all. A future in question. Dependent on ice-covered seas, the polar bear is the prime symbol of global warming's impact on animals. Bears in the Western Hudson are especially vulnerable because they must go without food for months after the spring melt. If sea ice continues to shrink, scientists say, fewer polar bears will be born, fewer will survive, and the species will suffer. About 10,000 people arrive in Churchill every fall to see polar bears. Visitors gather at the lodge, a research and tourism outpost built from conjoined buggies. It's also home to PBI's newest technology, the Spotter RF, a compact surveillance device designed to contend with threats like drone attacks. Here, it's used to spot polar bears. In the most basic sense, the Spotter F is a motion detector, much like those used to turn porch lights on. As bears move on the tundra, they trigger the sensors. Their locations pulsate on a digital map, which can be analyzed by York and other scientists. The software performs well at night and in snowstorms, and may one day serve as an early warning system for Churchill. To keep us safe, Buggy One has backed into a fenced platform at the lodge, like a spaceship docking into port. Inside the lodge, the Spotter RF radar beeps to signal the approach of a trio of bears. One of them, precocious and curious, toddles near enough that we could poke a finger through the bars and touch its nose. York has told us about Bear Jail, an enclosure that captures bears in town so they can be relocated. But here, he says with an approving smile, we are the ones in the cage. The next afternoon, back out on the tundra, we watch skinny bears pace the shore. Some hunker down in kelp beds, chewing on the seaweed. A big male stomps the snow with both front paws. Another lies encircled in a snowdrift. When the tide comes in, sunlight escapes the patchy bank of clouds and brightens the mosaic of ice floes on the bay. From the willows, a mother approaches with a cub, their pace slowing as they take in two large bears skulking where the ice meets the water. The mother looks past them, and from the deck of the vehicle we follow her gaze, out to the bay's churn. York hopes the ice will be solid soon. If they go too early and the ice breaks up, they'll have a long swim back to shore. We'll finish today's episode with an article from Prologue titled Who's There? By Laura Hilgers, the hardworking nurse who envisioned a new way to know who was at the door. Marie Van Britten Brown, an African-American nurse living in Jamaica, Queens in the 1960s, was working odd shifts, as was her husband Albert, an electronics technician. When she arrived home late, she sometimes felt afraid. Serious crimes in Queens jumped nearly 32% from 1960 to 1965, and police were slow to respond to emergency calls. Marie wanted to feel safer at home. Enlisting her husband's electrical expertise, Marie conceived a contraption that could be affixed to the front door. It would offer four peepholes, and through these, a motorized video camera on the inside could view visitors of different heights as the occupant toggled the camera up and down. The camera was connected to a television monitor outside. A microphone was outside of the door, and a speaker inside allowed an occupant to interrogate a visitor, while an alarm could alert police via radio. Closed-circuit television, invented during World War II for military use, was not widespread in the 1960s, and the Browns proposed using the technology to create the first modern home security system. They filed for a patent for their device in 1966, citing Marie as the lead inventor. It was approved 3 years later. The equipment is not in production, the New York Times reported, but the Browns hoped to interest manufacturers and home builders. That never happened, presumably because the Browns system was ahead of its time. The cost of installing it would be pretty high, says Robert McCree, an emergency management expert at John Jay College of Criminal Justice in Manhattan. Marie's invention, though it didn't benefit them financially, would earn the Browns a measure of recognition in the tech world. The predecessor of today's home security systems, it's been cited in 35 U.S. patents. Companies first offered CCTV to residential customers around 2005, but Marie never saw her vision realized. She died in Queens in 1999 at the age of 76. As the tech has become cheaper and smarter, home security has grown into a $4.8 billion business in North America and is expected to triple by 2024. We've run out of time for today's episode of Smithsonian Magazine. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Jen Rogers, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's programming is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Keppen. We wish to thank them for their support. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.